It's the day before Christmas, and all through the land, the people were resting, the elections in hand. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to this edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principles and Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaels.
Well, Barry, it's very good to be with you. Boy, you did that fast. Came up that little rhyme. We now have to take an unofficial survey to determine whether that was really prose or doggerel.
I'm voting doggerel. No. Well, you know, Chuck, that's kind of a thing that I've perfected over the week. Well, gosh, I shouldn't use the word perfected. That's a misnomer. that I've practiced over the years of coming up with things on the fly, changing song lyrics, that kind of thing. I've been doing that since I was a little kid.
Oh, yes.
I remember running around. My older cousin and I had this one of those little handheld cassette tape players and recorders. You know, you remember the little things.
Oh, yes.
You see them in all the spy movies. They're the little flat ones that have the tape in the front and everything, and they're the silver and black.
Yep.
We would go around, and we would act like we were intrepid reporters, you know, and we'd be, you know, we'd ask, like, man-on-the-street interviews. And the answers coming back always were the taglines to some popular song of the day.
Well,
and we cut these mixtapes with all that kind of stuff.
You may not remember this, but there was a guy who sold millions of records in the 70s. Doing exactly that.
Yes.
He would do an interview, like, I remember the one that I remember distinctly was the guy was interviewing the shark from Jaws.
Yes.
Mr. Jaws, and he'd ask a question, and then the answer would come back as a clip of music. And it was actually very cleverly done. Some of it was absolutely hilarious. Some of it you went, huh?
Well, I always remember when we did this thing as kids, you could tell already what my future was going to be like because, you know, it was a lot of it had a political bent to it. And I remember this one vividly. The man on the street interview, we came up to President Richard Nixon. Now, remember, this is the 70s at the time. So coming up to President Richard Nixon and say, President Nixon, do you have anything to say back to people who are concerned about Watergate? And we hit the John Denver song that said, I'm sorry for all the lies I've told you. But that's the kind of stuff. And so, you know, I've kind of just, you know, riffed from there throughout my life. And my wife enjoys it, and so do my kids, when I can basically, like, parody, rewrite. I mean, Al Yankovic is one of my favorites.
No,
I love
course,
how he does
yeah.
parodies of popular songs. And I try to do that kind of stuff, too, and come up with, like, different themes and things of that nature. So it's a lot of fun. You know, it's what I do for amusement.
I'll be quite honest. My favorite Weird Al song is not a parody of a particular song. It's a style parody. And he does both. And he was parodying Devo's style.
Oh, yes.
And actually, he had one or two of the guys from Devo playing on the record, and it was called Dare to be Stupid. Dare to be Stupid is really one of my favorite Weird Al songs. You know, Run with Scissors. There's all these things. You know, mm-hmm. Take Some Wood and Nickels. It's all the cliches that your mom told you not to do. Is all the stupid things, you know, run with scissors, dare to, you know, take wooden nickels, search for Mr. Goodbar, all this whole list of stuff. Now, just in case you're really interested, and probably nobody is, but Merry Christmas, folks. We're at least lighthearted at the beginning here. The guy who used to do those records that I was talking about was a guy named Dickie Goodman.
Okay.
Dickie
Goodman.
That's
a name that I didn't hear because, you know, I kind of grew up listening to guys like Alan Sherman from the 60s.
Well, Alan Sherman. I loved Alan Sherman, too. Hello, Mudda. Hello, Fada. Here I am at Camp Granada. But Dickie Goodman, if you look up Dickie Goodman on Google, you will get Mr. Jaws, which was the big record. There were other records. Flying Saucer and some of these other ones that he did. But they were funny. After you'd heard them about 800 times, they got a little annoying. You know, that kind of novelty record, you can only hear a few times, and then you're like, okay, shut it off now. Everybody's heard it. That's plenty. Thank you. Now, 45 years later, 40 years later, I could listen to it once again if the feeling moves me, I might do that, but not today.
Okay, that's fine. But you're right. You know, it is, as this airs, it is the day before Christmas, and all through our house, creatures are stirring everywhere, including some mice.
Yes.
So, you know, it's frankly, there's an awful lot of things that are going on around this holiday season, Chuck, that, you know, usually things, at least for me, settle down. It gets quiet. You know, there's this little bit of a lull, especially with my job, between the last year's session and the next year's session. But that lull isn't happening right now because we've got some things that are still bubbling up there that may end up calling for a return of the legislature for a special, well, it wouldn't be a special session, it'd be a called session, but it would be a session that wasn't on the books, that would happen before the end of the legislative calendar year, which is something that's doesn't happen very often. I'll just put it that way. It doesn't happen very often. But right now, and we talked a little bit about this, I think, on the last program, you know, you have a situation where you've got some legislation that the Assembly passed, and they want to, that was kind of their Christmas gifts to some people, obviously, with heartbeat bill, to the pro-life community, and with some of the energy mandate relief bills to the big manufacturers. Those are bills that the governor has promised he will veto, and he did veto heartbeat, and he's got the energy bills in front of him, and he hasn't done anything with them yet. And so the legislature may be coming back probably next week, if necessary, to override vetoes of the governor. Obviously, they're not doing it this week. I just looked at the legislative calendar. The Senate has scheduled a session for the 28th. The House is not scheduled yet. And since we're now sitting here, we're recording on Wednesday, the 21st, for our Saturday program, it doesn't look like they're going to be scheduling one for this week. So if it happens, it's going to happen next week. So they're hoping that they'll be able to overturn the Grinch who stole Christmas's vetoes, and give some people a late but still very much acceptable Christmas present. And that leaves us being very busy. So things have been kind of hectic around here. I'm hoping to get ready for us to gear down and to have a little bit of that holiday relaxation, if that's the case. We're going to have family in, and we're trying to get everything, you know, ready for folks to come in, and that means mainly me. I had to go drag all of my stuff that's strewn throughout the far reaches of my house and kind of bring it home and collect it back into my office, which is always a fun job.
Yeah,
and I'm sure that a lot of people are doing quite the same thing. And so, you know, I don't know what you guys do to get ready for Christmas, but you know, we don't have a big, you know. We've decided not to do a tree. We just, you know, just the, our kids are fine without it. You know, we just basically do some lights in the house, and, you know, we do some quiet things, and it's really nice. And, you know, our family's gotten used to that, and that's kind of our groove, our vibe with it, our tradition, of understanding that, you know, every day should be Christmas, because every day is a day that Jesus Christ loves us and has saved us from our sins, and stands as our advocate before the Father, and we rejoice in that. And yes, you know, we've got a tradition around the world of observing this day, but I worry sometimes, Chuck, that maybe that tradition has become more of a self-centered tradition rather than a Christ-centered tradition.
Oh, well... Look, all you have to do is watch advertising on television, find out
that... I studiously avoid doing that.
Yeah, I know. But think about things. My son-in-law came in complaining because some stuff that he had bought from a big online retailer, the biggest online retailer, the orders were suddenly canceled and the price doubled. Well... that is the kind of thing you just really don't need at Christmas time, you know, especially when you're a young couple on a budget, you know, to have people who, well, we can't do it for that price. Okay, I understand that, but why'd you offer it for that price? And when it got back ordered and backed up and became a popular item, you know, under what circumstances are you merely just canceling orders and doubling the price? Well, they do it because they can get away with it, honestly. I've used this retailer many, many times. Now, what does it do? Well, it points out to the fact that, you know, there's a reason why Black Friday is called Black Friday, the Friday after Thanksgiving. And it has nothing to do with because, you know, things are draped in black because the employees are being killed by the, you know, all the onslaught of business. It's because businesses very often, especially mall-type businesses, and this is one of the reasons why you don't see shopping malls doing well these days, especially the enclosed malls,
right,
is the fact that many of them don't go into the black until that big shopping day for the year, which means they've got about 6 weeks to make their money for the entire, you know, to go into profit land for the entire year. Well, Barry, that's pretty bad. That's pretty bad if a business is not making money until the next to last month of the year.
Yes, that's true.
And it says a lot about how our economy is currently constructed, and it says a lot about the way we think about things. You know, I'm torn occasionally. I'm a businessman. I want to make money. I want to sell product. And what I don't want to do, one of the problems that you end up with is the fact that we live in a society where we live on credit. Now, I realize you don't do that. I have a lot of credit card debt, and it has to do with the fact that I was doing a lot of remodeling and car repair and I know you have that problem with, you know, neither one of us drive a new vehicle.
No.
And we have to keep those things running. And occasionally we do dumb stuff. Like I accidentally knocked a hole in my wife's windshield by buying some wood to do some remodeling work. Well, did I turn that into a, you know, I could have done an insurance claim with a $250 deductible. We'd have gotten $38 out of the thing. I said, no, you know what? I was dumb and tried to get the back door closed with a piece of wood that was too long in. I got to pay this out of pocket. So that kind of thing goes on. So what's happening? Well, people are getting further and further and further and further into debt. As the government gets further and further and further and further into debt. Now, go back to the Fed's recent decision that suddenly, you know, they have to raise interest rates. Well, why did they suddenly have to raise interest rates? Well, the claim was because the economy was doing so well. To which, as a wholesaler and a retailer, I laughed. The economy's doing well? The economy has been doing well since about 2007. We're now 10 years into what amounts to a downturn. I keep hearing about this recovery. When does it trickle down to me? And the answer is we keep borrowing and borrowing and borrowing money. I'd like to see the estimates. A couple of years ago, we were talking about what the real debt is. Do you remember those shows that we did?
Oh, yes.
We talked about the real debt. And the real debt, we were talking about, you know, $15, $20 trillion, blah, blah, blah. Well, the real debt's actually over $200 trillion when you take into account unfunded, you know, things we're going to have to be paying out and that kind of thing. I honestly think the Fed raised interest rates because they would like very much for the economy to crash and burn for the incoming president. Now, pardon me for being paranoid, but Janet Yellen really doesn't like Donald Trump very much, and Donald Trump has already made noises about, you know, we could really replace the Fed with a computer program. Trump might be right, because all this manipulation of the currency, I'll be quite honest, they can't be doing any worse a job than the Fed is doing. So,
No, that's true. And really, when it gets right down to it, I just saw this thing because you know that Mike Mulvaney, who Trump, I believe, is working on to be in his cabinet, I believe, budget director. The liberal media just went apoplectic and posted this big article about how he had spoken to the John Birch Society, like that was like that was some major issue, and it's like, okay, well, so what? He spoke to a group that believes that the Fed's illegitimate. Yeah, okay, so what? He probably speaks to a lot of groups. I just left. You know what? This whole thing about fake news, this meme that went around during the elections that the Democrats were trying to push about fake news. There's probably no news more fake than what comes out in most major media on a daily basis, Chuck, because it's basically all carefully selected propaganda to push you to a preconceived conclusion that it's bad to be conservative, Christian, capitalist. I mean, you look at all the C's that you could be, and that's that would be bad. You need to be more progressive and tolerant, and I just can't even begin to tell you all of the ways that the media tries to push the American person, individual, and communities, etc. toward these preconceived notions. I mean, you saw it during this whole deal with the Electoral College. I mean, for goodness sakes, you and I both are students of the Constitution. We both are defenders of the idea of the Electoral College. But what the media was reporting around the Electoral College vote and what actually the Electoral College is and does, did those two things actually like line up in any way, shape, or form?
Oh,
I didn't see it.
Absolutely not. Now, here's what's interesting, and maybe we need to sort of gather this all together and do an entire show on the Electoral College. I think we need to. I actually heard some of the people who were proposing that Donald Trump electors become faithless. And they were actually saying the right things. The Electoral College was designed to make sure that only people who were fit to be president got to be president. Well, my son-in-law and I, again, were discussing the Electoral College last night, and we discussed the mechanics of it and how the mechanics have been changed. The original mechanics of the Electoral College were you were chosen generally by your state legislature. To go come to the state capitol and cast a ballot. And when you cast a ballot, you were supposed to cast a ballot for two people. You did not originally designate president and vice president. You simply chose someone and voted for them. And generally, the way the rule worked was you could vote for one person from your state and one person from someplace else, one of the other states. Well, that's still the rule. And the reason that's there is to keep, again, what the Electoral College is for, is to keep one or two states from completely running the board in an election, which is exactly what it did this time. This is why when I give my little lecture, and if you want to hear it, get in contact with us at www.principledpolicy.com, because I give about an hour-long presentation on the Electoral College, the history. It's called the Electoral College. Original intent, how it's broken, and why it still works. And we just saw it work because all the reports are talking about how Hillary really won by 2 percentage points, but virtually the entire margin came from one state.
California, right?
California. The vote was overwhelmingly pro-Hillary in California, and it was so overwhelmingly that it was literally millions of votes more for Hillary. So what would have happened? One state, one, would have run the board for the entire other 49. Because this is the way this happens in electoral history. When you look at it, it dampens out extremism in electoral politics. And let me give you an example. If you know anything about presidential history, Grover Cleveland served as president twice. Now, I don't mean he had two consecutive terms, because he didn't. He served a term, and then he sat out a term, and then he served another term. Now, why did that happen? Well, it's interesting to note that in the term that he sat out, Grover Cleveland actually won the popular vote, but he lost the electoral vote. Now, why did that happen? Well, it happened because Grover Cleveland, when he won in the North, he won by small margins, 50.5 to 49.5, that kind of thing. A few thousand votes here, there, and another place. Or when he lost, pardon me, when he lost in the North, he lost by tiny little percentages. The sentiment was very similar for the two candidates. But when he won big, remember that the South was back in the Union by the time Grover Cleveland was president. And when he won in the South, he won big. 70-30, 65-35. Won by hundreds of thousands of votes. So all these votes in the South stacked up. Well, the South was not an electoral college powerhouse, okay, even combined. So what happened? Grover Cleveland won the popular vote by this huge overvote in the South. Well, I don't want to say overvote, but this huge margin in the South. And he lost by tiny margins in the North and the West. Well, what happened? Well, Grover Cleveland got to sit out a term. And that's how the Electoral College worked. It dampened out that extreme vote in the South and sort of went with the general trend in the North and the West. That's what it's supposed to do. That's exactly what it's supposed to do. It's supposed to make sure that the urban centers don't overwhelm the countryside.
Well, yeah, of course.
Now, how does the New York Times put that? Okay, I have an article here that I'm looking at, and I have not sent it to you, and I will send it to you. New York Times ran an editorial 2 days ago, "Time to End the Electoral College." Now, if you want to know exactly what the reason why people argue this way, it's because they really don't have a valid argument. Let me give you the argument. Here's a quote from the article. "The Electoral College, which is written into the Constitution," no kidding, you think, "is more than just a vestige of the founding era. It is a living symbol of America's original sin. When slavery was the law of the land, a direct popular vote would have disadvantaged the southern states with their large disenfranchised populations." What's wrong with that picture, Barry? What was the largest state in the Union during the founding era, population-wise?
Well, it would probably have been Pennsylvania, wouldn't it?
Virginia.
Virginia. Okay.
Virginia. It was actually the largest territorially.
That's true. You're right.
It was the largest territorially, and it had the largest population. What was unique about Virginia in light of this argument? It was a slave state.
Well, that's true.
Is this argument valid? It is not. The fact is that...
who cares about the details? I mean, come on. We're trying to set a meme here.
Yeah.
That's usually the way that works, is we're going to spin this out here, and we're going to say this, and we're going to get people to come and adhere to it. But really, it has no basis in fact or reality or historical accuracy in any way, shape, or form.
Right. Well, that's the problem. And these guys basically come dangerously close in their argument to touching the third rail, and that is on this 3/5. Remember that slaves counted as 3/5 of a person for purposes of representation. Okay, this is another place where the meme explodes. Because in the South demanded, during the formation of the Constitution, the South demanded that their slaves be counted as one person for purposes of representation, and the North right. demanded that they be counted as zero people.
Exactly.
So this idea that somehow the South made sure that the slaves got counted as a non-person doesn't hold water. And
no, because the other way around, it was the North that was trying to do
that. And these guys have basically exploded their own myth. Now, they're not making that claim here, but here's what they say. When slavery was the law of the land, a direct popular vote would have disadvantaged the southern states. Nope, it would not have. With their large disenfranchised populations, counting those men and women as three-fifths of a white person, as the Constitution originally did, gave the slave states more electoral votes. Yeah, that's true. They did give them more electoral votes, but you know what? The populations in the North really weren't all that heavy either. Massachusetts was not heavily populated. Name other states. We were very lightly populated, period. Probably the most urbane place in the country was Virginia. Really was. So these arguments are silly. What they really mean is, now I can guarantee you, if the situation had been reversed, what you'd be hearing from the New York Times is, thank God for the Electoral College. You and I That's both know
true.
That.
That's true. Absolutely.
This is why...
Totally flipped on its ear.
Yeah, it would have been that way. Here's the problem. A Democratic candidate has lost twice this way in the last 16 years. That's why they don't like it. Because what we're seeing is now the separation of the rural areas from the coasts. From the more populous coast. What you're seeing is that there is a deep, deep, deep divide in this country, and it's on the basis of ideology of the left on the coast and the ideology of the center and the right in the middle. I mean, you can hardly call Illinois, which is turning out to be a very liberal state, you can't accuse them of being on the right. Now, really, why does Illinois lean to the left?
Well, there are a number of reasons.
What's one of the main reasons?
Mainly because the city of Chicago is
it's Chicago. It's Chicago. Chicago and the northern tier, Chicago and all the way across over to the Quad Cities. The two on the Illinois side on the Quad Cities is a fairly liberal territory. The rest of the state's very conservative. So Illinois tilts. Now, if we went back to the Electoral College the way it's supposed to be, and remember, what's it supposed to be? It's supposed to be that the electoral votes are, for the most part, awarded by congressional district. You would have seen a very, very different Electoral College picture than we saw. And that's how the Electoral College is broken, because most states don't do that. There are two that don't, and that's Nebraska and Maine.
Right.
We need to go back to awarding electoral votes. But politicians love winner take all, because basically, you know, you can pull off an Electoral College win by, you know, if you recall, we kept hearing how Hillary had it in the bag in the Electoral College because of this and this and this, and she's going to win this state and this state and this state and this state. And if you remember, Ohio was supposed to be one of the states that was going to go all Hillary all the way. She was going to win here by like 8 points at one point or something like that. And winner take all meant that she got all, 18? I think. Yeah, 18. She was going to get all those. Well, Donald Trump ended up getting them all, even though if we'd done it by congressional district, Trump would only have gotten the rural congressional districts. He probably would not have gotten most of the urban ones, even in a conservative bastion like Cincinnati. He might have gotten one or two of the congressional districts down there. So these arguments are empty. It's just basically... it's fodder for guys like Lawrence Lessig, who desperately wants. He's willing to hook up with guys like Mark Meckler of the Convention of States Project, in order to get what he wants. And this should be the clue to those of you out there who think that the Convention of States project equals some kind of conservative landslide and return to constitutionalism. Oh, there'll be a return to constitutionalism. It won't be the one we have now, but there will be one, and you won't like it. That's the issue.
Oh, absolutely. Well, you know, Chuck, that's again, we managed to get past that, and regardless of what you believe about the legitimacy or not of the president-elect and now certified president-elect with the certification of the Electoral College to be started here soon, when those votes that were given from the electors going to D.C. to finally certify Trump so that he can take the oath of office on the 20th of January. Well, you'd think that then everybody would just kind of settle in and say, okay, here we go, and, you know, for the next 4 years, we've got to put up with it, you know, if you're the leftist, right? But, you know what? That's the problem, Chuck, because here we go. Now, if you remember, 8 years ago, and then again in 4 years ago, were people screaming for a recount of the elections? Were people screaming for faithless electors? Were people screaming for the removal of Barack Obama because we didn't agree with it? I mean, as a concerted effort.
Well, look, there were people who said, it's not my president. We had people all over the spectrum, but the fact is, the guy got elected and we got to deal with it. That's the way the for the most part, the attitude was on the right.
Well, yeah, that's, and you're right, because the attitude on the right is, we will make the best of a bad situation, and we will try to live our lives, raise our families, run our businesses as best we can, even in the light of, you know, what we consider to be a very huge problem politically at the national level. The left isn't quite that way, Chuck.
No.
Because already, you know, the dust having barely settled since Monday on the Electoral College vote, you have some of the hardcore progressives, including our good friend Michael Moore, who's already out there tweeting, well, he's not president for 4.5 weeks. Next idea. In other words, how else can we derail this guy before he actually takes the oath of office?
Yeah.
Because obviously their big plan about sending letters and cajoling and threatening and making death threats in some cases to electors to go off the reservation, so to speak, didn't work so well for them. Actually, it didn't work at all for them because, as you mentioned earlier, yeah, you had a couple of electors who jumped ship on Trump, but you had more electors jump ship on Hillary. So in the end, the difference between he and she and their total count and the electors, he actually gained three electoral votes did margin on her.
Yeah.
He lost two, she lost five.
Yeah.
So he actually netted the difference between he and her now is now three electoral votes greater than it was before, kind of like the recounts. But so you had this group of these Hamilton electors, and we talked about them on last week's program, trying to stop Trump from getting to these 270 electoral votes. And so now they have put out a statement, Chuck, and they basically are saying that, you know, this is our response to his Electoral College win. And honestly, it's hilarious, Chuck. And of course, they've highlighted certain things in their statement. And I'm glad that they did this because it really shows you what's going on here. They started saying, although today's result, and that is that, you know, and they say they're upbeat by widespread grassroots and bipartisan support to stop Trump. Really? Two electors?
Yeah.
That was your that's your booing? And when you lost five for your favorite? Okay, well, whatever. That's fine. Make lemonade. It says, although today's result confirmed Donald Trump's victory over Hillary Clinton, and that, we should stop right there and just, that should be the statement that comes out from them. You know, yes, today's result confirmed Donald Trump's victory over Hillary Clinton, so let's all go home. No, it's further revealed his unprecedented unpopularity and underlined the urgent need for comprehensive electoral and political reform in the country. Now, Chuck, I understand what they're trying to say by electoral reform. That's get rid of the electoral college, go to online voting, and make the national popular vote winner the winner. We get that. Political reform, Chuck. What does that mean? At least to the progressive left.
Political reform means make it quote unquote more democratic, which means really make it less democratic.
Well, no, actually, it does mean make it more democratic, and that means that you invalidate any Republican or conservative who happens to want to cast a vote or be run for office.
Big D Democrat.
Big D Democrat. That's right. Yeah. That's right. So that's what they're talking about here. And then they go on here and says, and of course, the snowflakes have to whine a little bit. We have not had the benefit of an intelligence briefing that could have informed our decision making today. Okay, I've seen some of the intellectual prowess you've been putting forward so far. I'm not sure anything could have informed your decision-making because you had your mind made up before you went in there. And so that's all fine. And this is their little and now they're saying that Trump's presence in the Oval Office represents a crisis for the Constitution, the economy, and the country. And I would have to say, in what way would that be any different than Barack Obama's presence in the Oval Office representing the same things?
I wasn't going to bring this up, but I am one of those people who reads Breitbart.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. We'll get you some absolution.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah. Get me forgiveness. There was an article in Breitbart on Robert Reich. If you remember who Robert Reich was, he was a budget director, I think, for Bill Clinton.
Wasn't he also the Secretary of Labor?
Yes, he was Labor Secretary.
Yeah, okay. Labor Secretary.
Not a budget director, he's a Labor Secretary. Okay, what does he say? He goes, well, Trump leans toward totalitarianism, unlike Barack Obama. Okay. Who's the guy with a phone and a pen? Who's famous for the phrase, I have a phone and I have a pen?
That would have been Paul Begala talking about Bill Clinton.
No, that was Barack Obama talking
I forgot. I'm sorry. Begala was stroke of the pen, law of the land kind of cool.
Kind of cool, yeah. The, the Democratic presidents seem to love to brag about the fact the usurped power of being able to simply sign executive orders. Well,
yeah.
I would invite you to go to Article 2 of the Constitution, which is the section that deals with the powers of presidents, and tell me exactly where the executive order power is. Now, you and I know what it is because, as we've taught our Constitution class, we've outlined what the power is, because there is such a power. But what's it for? It's an internal device that the president can use to force his cabinet officers to follow existing federal law.
Right, exactly.
Now, what does that mean? Does that mean the president can just sign an order and grab a bunch of land and take it from private hands into the from state hands into the federal government? And the answer is no. There's no such provision in the Constitution.
Well, can he also take a pen and sign a document and say that there can be no oil exploration in anywhere in around the country ever permanently?
No.
Well, but he just did. So, well, you know, that and he's complaining that it's permanent, and so you can't do anything about it. And the way I look at it, it's like, yeah, and the agency that you would be using to enforce that executive order would be the EPA, correct?
Yeah.
There's an easy thing to do about that. Just dismantle the EPA. And it looks like Trump's pick of the Oklahoma Attorney General for the EPA director might just be heading that direction, since the man has at least three different lawsuits against the EPA.
Yes.
Currently. So it's always great to put someone who's a critic of the agency in charge of the agency, because you know you're going to get reform at that point.
Yeah, real reform. And in fact, there's been an issue already in that Trump said, I'm going to demand to know certain individuals inside agencies who did certain things. And one agency, and I'm trying to remember which it was, it may have been the Department of Energy, I can't remember for sure, but basically said, we're not going to give you those names. Well, if Donald Trump signs an executive order requiring the head of that agency to give over those names, they'll be given over. And you know what will happen to those people. They won't be fired because you, under the Civil Service Act, you essentially can't fire. It's very difficult to fire people. Especially if they're under civil service tenure. What happens to them? They basically get the office down by the boiler room that's about the size of a broom closet, and they get to rubber stamp documents. You simply demote them and give them nothing to do. Now, what do? Well, their career's dead. You know, especially, think about this. You're rolling the dice on a re-election of the president. If you're stuck in your basement office rubber stamping documents by the boiler room for 8 years, and you're in your mid-40s when you start, well, 8 years later, you're 52 years old. Let's say you're 45, you're 53 years old. You're about 12 years from retirement. You're not going anyplace. And you have to think in those terms.
That's true.
Our good friend Charlie Smith, who taught at Camp American and has been a speaker and is has been around in the battle for, oh gosh, decades, 60 years, 50, 60 years. He's talked about this. He goes, you don't kill a federal agency off by simply eliminating it. What you do is you cut their budget and tell everybody salaries are frozen. All salaries are frozen. The size of the agency is frozen, and all moves upward are frozen. What happens to that agency? It dies on the vine.
Yes, it does.
Because your young, vibrant people won't come in because, A, there's no room for them, and, B, they see there's no future on this agency. So what happens to it? It becomes the Bureau of Weights and Measures. Nobody's in it. It's dead. Now, can it be revived at some point? Yeah, but that takes years. It takes years to get it all back. And what'll happen? Well, you'll see boo-hooing in the Washington Post and New York Times about how all these people were just trying to do the right thing and now are now stuck in these mundane jobs that are going nowhere. Oh, boo-hoo. You know, you're the dodo at this point. You chose a bureaucratic life. You live by the bureaucratic sword. You die by the bureaucratic sword. That's reality.
That's the reality of the situation.
So I personally think that's a great thing. Because remember, how did the EPA come into existence, Barry?
Oh, it was signed into law by order by Richard Nixon.
That's right. No law. It was an executive order by Richard Nixon.
That's right.
Yeah. He created an agency by fiat. Now, is that a legal agency? It is not. It's nothing close to legal.
So really, in this situation, you really could get rid of the agency just by repealing an executive order.
Well, you could. Yeah.
You could. In this instance, that's all it takes, because if there was no congressional law to establish the EPA, then it's just a paper agency.
Well, you and I both know what would happen, though. It would go to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court would hem and haw, and John Roberts would say, well, this is a secret vote, so nobody knew how anybody voted. And they'd all vote to say, well, no, it really is an existent agency, and there's nothing you can do about it. You and I both know that's what would happen.
Yeah, you and I both know that, that's for sure.
And
we base that knowledge on the fact that we've seen it happen before.
Yes, we have. I mean,
seen it happen before.
Not once. I mean, John Roberts has what a disappointment. I mean, there were a lot of people, and we warned people when this came up, especially some of our pro-life friends who were all, you know,
But we won't use this program to say I told you so.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, we will. Oh, yes, we will.
Yeah, we will. Of course, we will.
Because we need the reason is we need to. You got to tell people, it's like, look, you got to stop with the thing. I don't want to be the bearer of bad tidings, but folks, prepare to be deeply disappointed with the upcoming presidency. I'm not liking what I see in some of the cabinet picks. We'll see what that this all comes around to, because Donald Trump's a different kind of president than anybody's been in 100 years more.
Oh, since probably Calvin Coolidge. Yeah. I guess.
Well, maybe even before that. Yeah,
even before Cal.
Because think about this. You know, I was going to say 100 years. Well, that puts him in the progressive era. So, although he is a progressive. Let's not kid ourselves. And there's a thing somewhere today I was seeing, and it was about, I think it may have been on Drudge. It had a picture of Chuck Schumer, who basically said, well, I don't have any problem with Trump's multi-billion-dollar plan for infrastructure. Well, that's not shocking. Chuck Schumer loves that kind of stuff. The fact is, infrastructure, what do you mean by infrastructure?
Do they mean roads and bridges and highways, that's one thing.
That's one thing. Do they mean, you know, underground cables and all this other stuff? There's all kinds of stuff that infrastructure can be.
Mm-hmm, true.
Infra meaning under. Basically, what you're talking about is stuff that foundational is what they're talking about. Our infrastructure, remember, we've been hearing the meme forever. Our infrastructure has been crumbling, and we need all this investment from the federal government. Well, gosh, you know, we put the stuff up originally. I'm no longer a Westerville resident, but if you drive around in Westerville, especially on the south side where I used to live, the roads have been torn up there for going on 2 years as they put in infrastructure. They separated the storm and the sanitary sewer. Why'd they do that? Because the EPA demanded it. And it costs kajillions of dollars. What else did they put in? They're putting in fiber optic cable. Why? I don't know. Nonetheless, they're putting in fiber optic cable for, you know, information systems is what they claim. Well, yes. Tearing up the roads for 2 years to do some of this stuff that could have been done piecemeal. Okay. I hope somebody got a grant. One of the reasons I left Westerville because the taxes were just absolutely getting out of hand. And this is why, folks. Right. So infrastructure is what you want it to be.
Yes.
And, absolutely. You know, right now, I think they want it to be roads and bridges. And if you recall, how long ago was it that the bridge on, I-35 in Minneapolis collapsed?
Mm-hmm. Yes, there's definitely a major collapse there.
Yeah, so a lot of bridges are in bad shape. Why are they in bad shape? Well, because the states refuse to maintain them. Why do they refuse to maintain them? Because they're busy spending money on social programs. They're spending highway dollars on social programs. Folks, you pay a tax to repair the infrastructure of your roads and bridges every time you buy a gallon of gas.
Absolutely.
And what's being done with that money? Well, it's not. Most of it is not being used on roads and highways. It's going into a general fund. Some of it is earmarked, but a lot of that money is general funded, which means it goes out for all kinds of stuff. Basically, paying bribes to voting groups.
Ah! Well, yeah, I mean,
not direct. They're not handing out cash, but what they're doing is
put this way: the those funds are sort of like the lottery. Yeah, absolutely. All the money that goes into the lottery goes back to education, and then we take the exact same amount of money out of the education budget and roll it into other things because that's what we're going to do with it anyway.
Yeah,
use it to pay for our pet projects to encourage legislators to vote for these bloated budgets, because that's really what that gets down to, Chuck. You use those incentives in order to get legislators who otherwise probably would look at it and say, I don't think this is a good idea. But then if you throw a major construction project or a park or some, you know, naming issue that they can do in their districts into that budget. All of a sudden it becomes, oh, it's the greatest thing since sliced bread. We got to vote for it because they know that bringing home the bacon to the district is what it's all about in getting reelected.
Well, of course, that reelection thing is absolutely important. This is why you saw a lot of people, the pressure was suddenly on in the last session of the legislature. The pressure was on for a number of things. They smelled the sea change in the attitude, and that's why, after 6 years of trying, they were able to pass bills like Heartbeat. That's why John Kasich was essentially had his arm twisted into signing the campus concealed carry bill. John Kasich, yep. You know that John Kasich had college administrators all over him about that bill. Don't sign it. Don't sign it. Don't sign it. Well, what happened? Of course, we get a terrorist who basically goes in and tries to do a and not just tries to, terrorizes the college campus at Ohio State University. And luckily, because a fire alarm had been pulled, and we still don't know what that's all about, I'll be quite honest. Who pulled the fire alarm? That's what I want to know. Because a fire alarm had been pulled, there was an armed policeman there who just happened to have had some very important anti-terrorism training, who dropped the guy with like two shots. And I mean an instant drop. He was done. He did not linger. He was dead. Now that's actually some fancy shooting in a crisis situation. You know, everybody thinks they might be able to do it. This is one of the reasons that people are so afraid. Oh, you'll just start blasting bullets all over the place. Well, okay. But nonetheless, there are situations when, if you recall back to college shootings like Virginia Tech, where the guy went nuts and everybody, dozens of people got shot, many killed, because nobody could defend themselves. And the cops wouldn't go in and get the job done because they're like, we're not going to go get shot up. We got to know what the situation is before we go in. Meanwhile, the guy's going room to room shooting people. Well, in a concealed campus carry situation, that might not have been so easy for him.
And probably not.
That's the entire point. That's the entire point of that. Now, again, John Kasich, do you really, and let me ask you your opinion. Do you really think John Kasich wanted to sign that bill?
In reality of it, probably not. But to veto that bill with the push that he'd already had in regard to immigration issues might have really considerably tilted his boat so far that no amount of bailing could have gotten it, kept it from capsizing.
Yeah, I think, honestly, this is where I thought maybe the analysis that he understands that his political career is over, where he may not understand that, and that's why he did sign this bill, because we know that there's a lot of anger out there over the Heartbeat bill, a lot.
Yes.
You know, after working this hard, he vetoes it in favor of a bill that really doesn't do much. It does a little, and we're happy it's signed in the law, but it doesn't do all that much. And I'll be quite honest, I'm positive that he can't really understand what the beef is.
Oh, no, I think you're right. I don't think he does.
Because he really doesn't understand the pro-life position. Because I don't really think he's pro-life. And that's the issue. He's pro John Kasich's life. The life that he wants to lead. And that's in higher office. So, I don't know what this says exactly about his future running plans. He's going to have to assuage the feelings of college presidents, especially probably Ohio State's college president. You know, Ohio State kind of got hoist by their own petard on that thing because they were inviting in. They desperately wanted to become a sanctuary area for some of these immigration you know, quote unquote refugees. You'd yep. think that somebody would have like looked twice at a refugee that went from Somalia to Afghanistan or to Pakistan, and looked at his associations while he was in Pakistan. But that being said, at least if you go on campus, you won't be locked in the deepest, darkest dungeon if you happen to have a concealed weapon with you.
Well, and that's a good thing.
Yeah, of course it's a good thing. I mean, Barry, it's dangerous down there. I bottom line, it's dangerous down on campus at night.
I can
remember in the 80s when I was down there taking tests way back in the deep dark recesses, way over on the far west end of campus, not across the river, but way back in there. It was dark back there, and sometimes you take a final that didn't get out till 10 o'clock at night. And I had to walk all the way across campus, across the oval, and to get to where I had parked my car. I didn't mm-hmm. like it, and wished really badly that I had a pistol with me. So, 33 years later, I can do that. Of course, yeah, I'm not going back to school at Ohio State, so don't worry about it.
Well, you know, and I was a student at Ohio State University, and this was after my undergrad, but, you know, we lived near campus, and I got mugged one night. You know, I got hit over the head with a beer bottle by some guy who wanted to try to take my wallet. He was extremely unsuccessful in the attempt, but I still ended up having to go to the emergency room and get a bunch of stitches in my head because he broke the beer bottle over my head and then thought that was going to intimidate me enough that I would just hand over his wallet or my wallet to him. Unfortunately for him, he was standing between me and the concrete block wall that I was about to drive him into, which I proceeded to do. And you talk about someone who changed their plans rapidly from being a felon to being a fleer.
Yes.
You should have seen this guy run. But anyhow, and thankfully, you know, I didn't need to necessarily have a firearm, but if I would have had one, then I probably could have had the person arrested for assault and attempted robbery, yeah. et cetera, and gotten him off the streets rather than him being able to get away and, you know, perpetrate on somebody else.
Well, it's not about shooting someone. It's about keeping someone from shooting you, right?
Yeah. I make sure that people understand. I didn't say shoot.
Yes.
I said to hold him so that he could be arrested by law enforcement.
Well, you know, that's the bottom line. People say, you just wanted to shoot him up. No, I don't. I'd really rather not. I'd really rather not. I want to prevent myself from being shot.
Yes.
Myself and others. The minimum amount of force necessary. And, in fact, there have been numerous studies wherein simply the allowing someone to know that you have a pistol or a gun of some description is enough to make the potential felon flee.
Yes.
I've had that happen to me. One time, three guys were going to beat me up. They didn't like me for some reason. I don't know. They were drunk at a football game or something. They didn't like me, and they were headed toward me rather rapidly. And I simply pulled my 357 out from under the seat of my car and checked the cylinder. And when they spotted that, they turned around and went the other direction.
Yeah, you made sure that they saw you check the cylinder.
I made sure that exactly. I made it visible. And the minute I made it visible, they rethought discretion really is the better part of valor, and we're not going to do this.
Yep.
Well, you know, with that, we're out of time. What else is new? We're always out of time. We want to wish everybody out there a merry, merry Christmas. A very merry Christmas. Folks, may you remember the reason for the season. Please be in a good, church on Sunday morning worshiping the Savior. I realize that, you know, it's Christmas morning, but by golly, it is Sunday. It's the Lord's Day. Be sure you be in church on Sunday. And with that, you know what we think. We want to know what you think. www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. And join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.